Good afternoon. My name is Mike Mattuzzi, and I'm the host of Contemporary Spirituality. Joining us this afternoon at noon is my friend Charles Kennedy. A couple things about Charles. We went through the Living School, Richard Rohr's two-year program, 2015 to 2017, and in that program, I think we had about 150 people in our cohort. They break you down into small groups of nine, so you can really develop meaningful relationships with that small group. Our small group is still intact. We still meet quarterly, and we spend a lot of time together during that two-year program. So I got to know Charles well. We found out that coincidentally we grew up maybe 5 miles from each other, didn't know each other then, but both grew up in Afton, which is a little suburb of St. Louis, Missouri. So with that said, Charles, how are you this afternoon?
Hey, I'm good, Mike. I'm in Dallas for reference point. I'm good today, Mike. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Well, let's start in the beginning. Tell the listeners a little bit about anything that was formative in your growing up period from a spirituality standpoint.
Yeah, it's interesting what just kind of popped into my brain as you said it, and I've never thought of it this way before. I think one of the things Father Richard Rohr says is those early days, or those early parts of our life, are about creating the envelope. And boy, that's certainly what happened with me. Mike mentioned we grew up 5 miles apart. I went to a Catholic grade school, St. Dominic Savio, and I recall really enjoying that up until about eighth grade, I would say. I was a Latin altar boy, and I just recall all that being really meaningful to me. My little gospel book, and I think that's what it was called. And I grew up in an alcoholic family. My poor dad, he didn't get the opportunities that I got to find another way in life. But it meant I grew up at kind of a raging dinner table every night. And so nonetheless, I thought the objective was to be good, you know, that it my story really is about almost, you could say, one thing. It's how you find out that God loves you because he is good, not because I am good. And I didn't know anything like that. Somehow what I heard is I needed to be good, and I couldn't. And when I started doing the things I was told not to do, you know, my nose didn't fall off. And so I thought, well, it must be okay to do it. And so I was kind of off to the races, developing a very self-centered, self-will run life. And, with that, I went away to college, got an engineering degree. I had a very high bar in my life for some reason about what success meant. So I studied hard in school, and yet I also, I guess as it would be told, played hard. And that's when I started drinking to make that, it made that pain go away of not feeling like I fit in and didn't know how to act or even how to be. I remember one semester of my 8 semesters at the University of Missouri, one semester, I don't know how it happened, I got in Campus Crusade for Christ. And I was in a very drinking fraternity, by the way. But nonetheless, all I know is I remember that was my one semester that I felt a little bit okay about being Charles. And I can't describe it any better than that. But that's what happened that semester. But I didn't know how to comprehend changing a self-centered life and pointing it in another direction. And I had a lot of drinking to do. Nonetheless, I got out of college. I headed to Texas. It was the hippie days. And instead of using my engineering degree, I didn't want to do that. And I got a van and I started smoking marijuana and drinking and started a business selling black light posters and patchouli oil and stuff like that. And that was a business I then had for almost 30 years. So that became my first adult life career, I guess you'd say. But in that was a lot of drinking. And in my 20s, I was arrested 13 times for drugs and alcohol. fact is, I hold a record that can't ever be taken from me. I'll never forget the jailer looking, and there's a jail out at DFW Airport. Most people don't know that. I do. Once I was arrested getting on the plane, and once I was arrested getting off the plane. And I recall the jailer looking in at me and saying, "Mr. Kennedy, you're our first two-timer." So there you go. Nonetheless, I finally, in 1982, I think I was 32 at the time, after the 13th arrest and my lawyer telling me I was going to go to jail, which I didn't see. My business was starting to do better. I was starting to wear Armani suits, you know, and my vision of myself wasn't going to jail. And so I went away to this little treatment center in the hill country of Texas, and they gave me the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I read the third step, made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood him. And I remember sitting out on this hill and just pondering the idea of his will, not mine, his will, not mine. And that was kind of a first moment, you know, for me, of my life taking a different trajectory. I came back to Dallas. I got going to AA meetings a lot. I enjoyed the fellowship a lot. God took away the desire to drink, which I thought was the idea. And the point being, I didn't work the steps. I told myself the lie that doing the work was for people that still wanted to drink, and I still didn't want to drink, so I didn't need to do the work. That was just a very convenient out for me.
And Charles, sorry to interrupt, but for those not familiar with AA, and I'm not, I would be one of those, what does that mean, doing the work? What would the expectation be?
Yeah, doing the work would be working the 12 steps.
I see.
Many people, I've heard the phrase that the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are God's gift to the 20th century. These 12 steps are right out of any spiritual tradition anyone might read. These 12 items of the way people can transform their life and be happy, joyous, and free, they would be these 12 steps. And God, most anybody, I've never met a spiritual person that didn't see these as divinely inspired. So I didn't do the work, so I didn't change. We have a phrase, which is, what happens when a drunken horse thief gets sober? Well, you have a sober horse thief. That's what I was. So I eventually relapsed because of not doing the work. I lost my marriage at that time. Thought I was going to lose the business. Landed in a halfway house in Prescott, Arizona. This is 1988. They finally got the words out of my mouth to another man, "Will you help me? Will you help me?" I just can't even tell you how hard that was for me, showing how strong my self-will was.
Yeah, and it's me. Excuse me, Charles, but I'm trying to keep the readers along with me in your story. But 1988, are you still ascending from a business standpoint, the Armani suits and all of that? Are you still enjoying it?
Yeah, that's a great question. In my relapsing, I hadn't lost the business. The business had started to do just good enough that I could be away from it a little bit. And I had a team I'd put around me that it could still function and grow. When I went away to the halfway house, that is a good question. I said to my three top managers, they were the ones that knew about my situation. I told them, I said, "You can't hide me. So you guys run the business. And if people just keep saying we need to talk to Charles, I don't know when I'll be back. And you just tell them that I have a dependency problem and I'm working on it, and leave it at that."
But to keep everybody on the same page, the business started out kind of hippie, black lights, selling out of a van or something. In 1988, yes. Is it the same business or something different?
No, by then I'd moved to Dallas. There's a market center in Dallas. I'd gotten a showroom. I was the guy with the little showroom in the corner. but I had a, God blessed me. I don't know about blessed being the word, but what he did give me was right brain, left brain. I had a mathematical problem solving right side of my brain, so I could write equations to solve problems and create commission splits and all of that. We didn't have computers back then. I was the computer. Nonetheless,
right.
And I had a good eye for art and product. So somehow God had led me into something that let me use those attributes, and I had kind of learned a different way of structuring the business. And the I'm glad you asked me that, Mike, because there was an important moment, a very important moment in the period that I was sober but not doing the work in the mid-80s. And I'll never forget this. I took a shower one morning, and when the nozzle, the impact of the shower hit my head, there was an explosion in my brain. I'll never forget it. And the explosion said this: what if a business is not about money? What if a business is about people? And that changed my context of what I was doing, because I was growing. My business model was working. I was hiring a lot of salesmen. My model was to hire, I found, was females whose children now are in high school, and they wanted a little career of their own, and they loved product, and this was going in the stores they'd be going into anyway, and now they were going in there with products. So, and what I learned is that I was in the human resource business. And so I didn't worry about the retailer who we sold our products to, who they thought they were number one, and I didn't worry about the manufacturers we represented. They certainly thought they were number one. I let my staff worry about those two groups. I just took care of my staff, and the business exploded. It just exploded. It was an unbelievable thing to see what happened when that took place. And I had a spiritual life back then, even though I hadn't worked the steps and really changed altogether. I was definitely a little more right size, let's put it that way, and enough more right size to have had that explosion in my head about money and people.
Right.
Nonetheless, I did relapse, though, from not doing the work, and that's when I eventually landed in Prescott in 88, asking the man to help me and doing the work. Came back to Dallas. Got very involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, sponsored a lot of people, and this would have been now the late 80s, early 90s. And it's when I really found out what my problem was. You know, as simple as it is, and I don't want to get too lost in this, I don't think it's the context of this discussion, but you see, I thought my problem was I drank too much, and that wasn't my problem. We learn in Alcoholics Anonymous, if we, and this is a hard for even the people in Alcoholics Anonymous to see, and until you see this, you don't understand your problem, and you can't solve a problem if you don't know what it is.
Right.
And my problem was I couldn't drink enough.
Mm.
You see, I've got a different chemistry than 9 out of 10 people. 9 out of 10 people have I'm told you guys have a natural governor, and if you put too much in you, you want to get sick. You get a little dizzy. You get a little nauseous. That's not what alcohol does to me at all. I put some in me, and my body just says, let's go get some more. And so I didn't realize that my body was different. And that's what is alcoholism. It's a body that just can never get enough in it. So it doesn't stop. And once I learned that, then I could do the work, and I found that my solution was God, that step two is giving my life to him. And that brought me to steps 3 through 9, which is the practical program of recovery, which in any life, in any spiritual life, I think it's the steps. And the main step was taking an inventory of myself, of looking inside and realizing what all my resentments and fears were about, because they're the main culprit, is fears and resentments, which are the byproduct of wrong thinking and wrong believing. And so the way we did the work, I was finally did it, was just to pick out a piece of paper and think one thing. What are you mad at? And finally, the dam burst open. I couldn't write fast enough. Mike, I realized I was mad at everybody and everything.
Mm.
And I didn't know it. I didn't know that about me. And then I learned I wasn't so much mad at people as I was mad at what they did. It was their behavior. It wasn't the person. And then I found out, looking at myself, that what it was really about is my pride and my desire to be liked and my financial insecurity and my emotional insecurity. But that was really the culprit. And then I realized that why I was that way is because I was selfish and self-centered and dishonest and inconsiderate. And that's mm-hmm. what had to change. And so the self-examination process and going over that with another person who'd done the work, who could help me spot things I couldn't see. And that's when I realized that I wasn't running my life at all. What was running my life was my desire to be liked by other people and my lack of financial security. That's what was running my life. And with that, I could get onto the other steps, which was asking God to help me to remove my selfishness, my self-centeredness, my inconsideration. And now I'm doing business with God through self-examination.
Mm.
We eventually realized, and this took me years, years and years and years, was we humbly asked God to remove these things. And that's the part that took me a long time. And so I'm moving through a lot of ground here, but I started reading self-help books and things like that. The point being, thinking that I could do the heavy lifting, that I could do the work. And that's not the step. The step is humbly asking him to remove these things. And that's when I hit another bottom. And this would have been about 2000, I would say. To kind of back up a little bit, I eventually sold that business. I had an opportunity to sell it. I thought it was to grow it into a national business. It was these Harvard MBAs that I sold it to, and that turned out not to be what they had in mind. All they wanted to do was cut out overhead and try to take it public. And thank goodness I got away from that. And that's when I landed out in Colorado, and I had another career building homes and furnishing them, and really high-end homes out in Colorado. But my time out there, what was so great is I got to chair our board on drugs and alcohol in Aspen, Colorado. I got to sponsor a lot of men. But in that period, I was still driven by outer success. I wasn't drinking. I wasn't using. I was definitely sober. My life was helping other people. There was no question. I saw that. But I also still wanted more. And I couldn't see how that desire for more, how it poisoned my spirit, how it blocked me still from the kind of relationship with God that I thought I had.
Mm-hmm.
So sure enough, in 2008, when the market crashed, everybody was affected, of course, in one way or another.
Right.
But I had just taken on debt, bought three properties. I was in the worst position I could have been when that happened. And I thought I was going to lose everything. And that's when I realized that I had this fear in me that I didn't think I had about financial stuff. And I realized it had just gotten hidden by my success and that I didn't want to lose everything. And that's when I realized, well, if I didn't want to lose everything, I must not trust God the way I thought I did. And that was a real awakening for me. And eventually I landed back in Dallas to weather the storm of this with properties in Naples, Florida, and Aspen, that being the outer part of my life. And I moved back where I wanted to do two things. I thought, get back to Dallas and be around my small grandkids and take them to all their Little League baseball games and all of that. That was attractive to me. And trying to start a nonprofit in Dallas in the drugs and alcohol field as a way of giving back what I had learned. But what I didn't realize is I still hadn't given it all to him.
Mm.
And in a breakup in a relationship, I was married one time. We were divorced, but stayed best friends. I'm sure we would have remarried, but she passed of cancer during all of this. So I was in a relationship with somebody that really mattered, and we broke up, and I was just so distraught. I can't even tell you. My distraught was not so much over the breakup. My distraught was looking at how I showed up in the relationship, still being judgmental and wanting a person to be the way I wanted them to be. And I was just tore up about that. And I'll never forget it. This would have been about 2012, 2013. And I found myself on my knees just crying to God. And I remember it came out of my mouth, "Lord, have mercy on me, I'm a sinner."
Mm.
And I, because the word sin had such negative connotations growing up, I was never able to think or say that word. But that night, it somehow made sense to me. And so that was another bottom in my life. And it opened doors that I could have never imagined. Right after that, people showed up in my life that were followers of Thomas Keating and Richard Rohr, and they wanted me to consider silence and meditation. And I said to them, "Well, I pray in the morning, and I've got my meditation books I read, but I've got four. My brain just goes too fast. I just can't be silent." And so they encouraged me to read Open Mind, Open Heart, and I read my first Richard Rohr book, Falling Upward. And so this slow change started to happen, and I finally tried 5 minutes. I set a timer on 5 minutes, and I remember them telling me, "Just don't quit. Just don't quit. That's all that matters." And boy, that 5 minutes, I thought that bell would never go off. One thing led to another. I eventually got led to the Living School and was accepted. And that's, of course, where Mike and I met. And as he said, our inner circle and the big circle of people. And it was so interesting, those 2 years. We read a lot of things. We had Cynthia Bergeau and James Finley as our mentor teachers. And, of course, Father Richard. And they'd give us things to listen to and watch and read every week. I probably put in 10 to 15 hours a week at this. I know a lot of my fellow brothers and sisters that were there put in more time, and probably some put in less, but I remember what I did. But what I never forgot is they never asked us if we did our readings or any of that. They never once asked that question. Here's what they did ask. "Have you done your 2 20-minute sits?"
Yeah, right.
And it just kind of got into me, this idea that God does the heavy lifting. God does the heavy lifting. Mine is to turn it over. Mine isn't to figure it out. One of the steps in any spiritual book isn't figure it out. It's always set it down. And that's why that title, Falling Upward, is so incredible. And so slowly but surely, starting in about 13 or 14, just before I went to the Living School in 15 to 17, I developed a meditation practice. At first, it was everything I could do to get to 20 minutes. I really struggle and still do with that second sit. As the pandemic hit, it's been a really great time for my spiritual life in many, many ways, because instead of just doing AA 12-step meetings, I start finding centering prayer Zoom meetings and centering prayer 11th-step meetings. The 11th step is sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, seeking only His will for us and the power to carry it out. And we are one of the things in AA that to me is so profound is that it's self-examination, prayer, and meditation that creates the unshakable foundation for life. And what I realized is early on in my spiritual path, I was doing the prayer part, and I was doing the internal investigation part, but I wasn't doing the meditation part, which is the sunshine. But now, finally, I was adding that, and oh my gosh, what a difference. I thought the fourth step, when I finally looked at myself, was the change that changed everything. Then when I finally did the ninth step, which is making amends, I did a two-week tour of Missouri, tracking people down to look them in the eye and say that when I did what I did, I was wrong. Mm-hmm. And I thought when I did that, I was the change that changed everything, because it was. It was so profound in my life. As a sidebar on that, because this was so meaningful, one of the amends I wanted to make was in St. Louis to the old girlfriend that I walked to St. Dominic's with every day. We went to the same grade school. We went to private high schools. We went to the University of Missouri together.
Mm-hmm.
But she was sick of my breaking up with her all the time, and she certainly wasn't going to get in the van and head to Texas. And so she got married right out of college, and I went to Texas, and we never spoke again. So it'd been many, many, 20 years or more, and I needed to call her father to get the phone number. And I can't tell you how much I did not want to call her father to get her phone number. Because,
yeah.
See, in my head, I'm the bad guy. In my head, yeah. I'm the bad guy. Well, I call him sitting in the basement of my parents' home, that same basement phone where I spoke to the girlfriend on as a scared teenager. And I called and I said, well, hi, Mr. Sweeney, this is Charles Kennedy. I'm sorry for that name. And he said, oh, my gosh, is this Charles? And I said, yes, Mr. Sweeney, it's Charles. He was so excited to hear from me. And I realized that broke that chain in my head.
Mm.
And so that's why these steps are so deep and so profound. When it comes to the amends, it says 9 out of 10 times, surprising other things will happen. And that was one of my surprising other things. I didn't see how important in my life calling that man was going to be. I thought I was tracking down the girlfriend to make the amends. By the way, I did find her, made the amends. We now talk about each other's grandchildren. Whenever I am in St. Louis, I see her. It is so great to be in each other's life. Oh, my gosh. I can't even tell you. Nonetheless, the next change that changed everything was certainly developing a meditation practice.
Yeah.
Today, I'm probably in 4 or 5 prayer groups that do a 20-minute sit as part of a Zoom meeting, and then either Lecto Divina, or we share, or we read the St. Francis prayer, which is the way an 11th step Alcoholics Anonymous would do a meditation meeting. And then there's many of them now, Zoom meetings everywhere. There's in fact one in Boulder, Colorado, that's every morning at 8 o'clock, and that's become my morning meeting, my 20-minute meditation with my dog. I got a puppy about 10 months ago. So through all of this, I'm back in Dallas. My grandchildren are now in college. I don't know about the nonprofit. It still might happen. I don't know. It's got a new life in it right now, so time will tell. But about 2 years ago, in June of 2 years ago, I had such a terrible pain in my back, and I was getting massages and body work. I thought it was muscular, and finally I went and got an MRI and found out that I had a golf ball-sized tumor on my sacrum, and it was an NET cancer tumor, and that we couldn't take it out because we'd have to cut all my nerves, and I'd be an invalid. As one doctor even said, I have a morbid life. And so that was another moment when, you know, when I first was diagnosed with the cancer, it was, well, I trusted God. I was really in an odd sort of a way okay with that. But boy, again, I realized one thing I didn't want was to live the rest of my life in a wheelchair. I could tell, boy, that that one wasn't easy for me to just to think about in God's will. Nonetheless, we radiated it. It got just small enough to get me out of most of my pain. And we give me this big shot every 28 days for it. We're running a lot of tests on me now. And so I'm going down to MD Anderson. This would have been about 18 months ago. And one time when I'm down at MD Anderson in Houston getting a second opinion on this tumor on my sacrum, they say, you know, we've got a lot of tests on you going back, and we've noticed something on your lung that we don't like. And sure enough, after we tested it, I'll never forget sitting there and the doctor telling me I had stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer and it had spread to my brain. And I recall going back to the hotel down there. We didn't expect that news, or family would have been with me. And that was a difficult day. But I want to lift my hat right now and lift up MD Anderson and all the people down there. It's like the United Nations. It's people from all over the world that are in the healthcare business at all the different levels they're at, who all had to, you know, work to get their profession and then get their green card and then get to the States. And boy, if you ever forget we're an immigrant nation, go to a place like MD Anderson. It so lifts me up. I just have to say that to be around it. And what I'm getting at is that day, the shuttle driver from the hotel, who's from Africa, noticed my cheeriness in the car that day as he picked me up, and I told him the news I'd gotten. And he says to me, he said, I get off work at 3:00. You want me come and get you and take a walk? And this is what it's like down there. So I've been going there the last 18 months. We radiated my brain. My brain has been clear now from the cancer for about a year. Two more spots showed up on my lungs, so I was down there with 19 days of radiation recently. I will go back early September to retest everything. I've been on immunotherapy every 2 weeks now for about a little over a year. I get my immunotherapy treatments here in Dallas. I'm very fortunate that my body tolerates all these treatments, whether they be the shot for my tumor, whether they be the immunotherapy for my lung cancer, or whether they be the radiation, because we've radiated 3 parts of my body now. And my body tolerates it. I get to just get on with my life mostly. I'm a little more tired. I got to go skiing, though, this year again. I became quite a skier when I lived in Colorado, and can't tell you the joy it gave me to still be able to do that. I don't know. I don't think about the wheelchair anymore. That never crosses my mind, really. The doctors never really answer how long I have. I have an incurable cancer, so we don't think that way. I'll say this, that when you realize that the countdown's on and you may not be around as long as you thought, it'll cause you to reevaluate a lot of things. It'll cause you to take a harder look at what's important. You're looking at what I think I need to have saved to spin off the kind of income I'd like to have to live in my retirement until 95 and da 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 da. Boy, that all changes when you don't even figure you'll get to 75. So I don't know. My life in many ways has been richer. My relationships are richer. Thank goodness for meditation. I just know that has changed so many things. It's like I'm a very responsible person, and therefore I get over responsible. And so once I kind of get onto something, I can get onto it too much, and that's when I block out grace. And today I want to live in a grace economy, you know, not a merit economy, as Father Richard puts it. I finally get that completely. I've always lived in a merit economy. And what I really believe for me is that meditation, if I do my two sits each day, I kind of behave like I understand that difference. I can't describe it to you. It's just I behave that way, and I don't get overly responsible, and I don't try to manage the results and all of that, and I get to more be part of a grace economy.
Yeah, let me make a comment for that I know or that I've observed. I've had the benefit of knowing you since 2015 and in observing you post-diagnosis. But one of the things I've noticed is, on a quarterly basis, and we've started this a year or two ago, we've gotten together in our cohort, or circle four, I think we were, circle of nine, to just kind of spend, an hour or so together and kind of check in and share what's new. And post-diagnosis, you were on one of these Zoom meetings, and you shared your diagnosis with us, but you were radiating, you were beaming in some way, you were full of gratitude and full of grace, and there was just a wonderful peacefulness and a wonderful surrender about you, which is, of course, counterintuitive in many ways, and I noticed that. I'm assuming others have noticed that, and I just maybe can you respond to that and unpack it a little bit? You know, how do you get there? How do you stay there when you get news that that essentially says, hey, this is incurable and the countdown is on, and we don't know how much time?
You know, I've got a little card here from Father's Day, this Father's Day. And here's from my grandchildren. Happy Father's Day, Grandpa. Thank you for everything you do for this family and for being such a great role model. I love you, Luke. Happy Father's Day, Grandpa. Thank you for all your sacrifices and life lessons you've taught me. Love, Jake. You know, that's the two that are in college. I don't know how to answer the question, Mike. I don't know what the other side is going to be. I don't really think about it. I'm very lame that way. It's not like I have this thought of what it'll be like on the other side. But I do know that today I got it. God loves me because He is good, not because I am good. And that just took the whole struggle away. So I know He's got me, whatever it is. I don't know any other way to put it.
Well, I love the concept, I know He's got me. Let me just share this, and hopefully this will be on point and maybe allow a little further dialogue, but Hannah's nephew, 14-year-old, young 14-year-old boy, died last week of brain cancer, and we were at the funeral Tuesday. And just a lovely kid with a lovely attitude who fought inoperable brain cancer for 5 years and actually was essentially in hospice for 4 months. But Hannah's daughter and this boy shared the same birthday. And he's just one of these old souls, mature beyond his years. And Anne just posted this on her Facebook, and I find it to be moving. I think, I think it just says a lot about spirit. And as I say that, I have temporarily lost it. So let me get back, because I really want to read it, because it's one of those comments that should be communicated correctly, word for word, as opposed to, you know, fumbling through a paraphrase. But so here's what she says on her little post, and I kind of want to know what you think of it. And they called him Nick the Brave. But she says, hey, this is the secret he let me in on. We've got one shot to be something on a floating rock. So I do anything but love and be loved. The rest is just a distraction.
Wow.
How about that? And kind of in that spirit, maybe, you know, can you share or unpack further just kind of much of what the new walk is like? You've shared, you know, many bottoms and your response to many bottoms. And there are, the common theme I'm hearing is I just keep turning it over to God, less of me, him, less of me, more of him. What's a new walk like? How's it different from before?
Well, I'm sure some of this is old age, just I'm older, you know, irregardless of my health condition. But life has finally slowed down.
Yeah.
Life was always very fast for me because I was always trying to get more done in any given day.
Yeah.
So I was very organized by that. And since I had an organized brain that could keep those plates spinning and moving forward, I sensed it was an attribute that I could balance and get that many things done in a day. And what I didn't understand is, yes, I could do that, but it didn't really make for a very peaceful day, in a way. And so today it's just gotten slower. And I think maybe this is causing me to be a little more thoughtful. Maybe I'm just in the moment more than I used to be.
Mm.
Maybe that slowing my brain down doesn't have other things running through it as much while I'm doing what I'm doing.
Mm.
And so I'm not so multitasking and thinking of the next thing as if, well, I got to get this done so I can get to that. So my life is richer that way today. And I think maybe, you know, that must be what God is. God is in that present moment, that now, that noticing the trees and the animals and hearing the birds and walking my little puppy every morning at 7 in the morning. And,
yeah.
And then doing my 20-minute sit with him. I don't know. Of course, this period has been overlaid right in the pandemic. So there's
right.
That too, you know, the 2 years that I've had this diagnosis is almost perfectly married the period of the pandemic.
Yeah.
So I'm sure somehow that's played a role too. In keeping me more home. In all of this, I finally created a home for myself here in Dallas. And, you know, that's something I'm good at. I've done a lot of that. That's what I sold in Aspen, Colorado. But this is for me, and it's got my stuff around me. And yet I can sure see that side of me that can get lost in the details, just like they're important.
Yeah.
And so there's that balance again, that balance between responsibility and grace. How do you balance those two? So life today is just a little, I just think it's slower, it's quieter. Somehow inside of that, it's richer, and it does feel just more of him. And less of me, and therefore it is all love. I have no problem at all seeing that life is all about love, seeing that God is love, and they're not just words now. I totally understand that.
Yeah, you understand the concept.
I had a little something I did. Maybe the listeners would appreciate this. I know I did. It was an experiment of sorts. This would have been, I don't know, I think it was last fall or maybe two falls ago. I still work at this now. I didn't give it up, but I really worked at it for 3 months. And that was every time I finished an act, this started when the pandemic wasn't on, so we were out and about more. Whenever I was in any interaction with somebody that helped me in any way, I would look them right in the eye and say, thank you for the great, great help. It didn't matter whether I'd gotten great help. That's how I ended it. And on the phone, I did the same thing. Thank you for the great help. didn't matter whether I felt frustrated. I just did everything I could in every interaction to say thank you for the great help. Guess what happened? It was about a month later, maybe 45 days. I know you know what the answer is. All I ever got was great help.
Yeah.
And I think that's just a simple way of describing how we co-create with God.
Yes, beautiful. Ron Rollheiser, Hannah and I just finished his two-year program, and towards the end, one of his big pieces is, hey, when you get our age, I think you and I are in our 60s maybe, or you probably, you may be early 70s.
I'm in my 70s.
But his thing is, at the end of your life, you only need four things. Thank you. Please forgive me. I forgive you. I love you. That's it. Forget everything else. And I just thought, what some lovely little guidance for the road, which is kind of what you're saying too. On another note, Ron also talks about Rollheiser. You know, this, and I think it's potentially a problem. It's a problem for me as a business owner and a goer, and you're wired the same way, because we always want to finish and get to the end and so forth. Yeah, is it okay? You know, we're going to not finish. We're going to end up unfinished, you know, things we're working on and ourselves and so forth, our own imperfections, warts and all. Are you at the point where that's okay? Because you've been a big doer in your life.
Yep, that's right. That's right. It is. It's just all okay. Exactly, it is.
Excellent. One last question. I'm going to let you go, Charles. Usually what happens is friends, families, I think folks in our Living School group will probably eagerly await this and listen to it. So people that know you will hear this and you know, that they'll hear it with knowing you and their impressions of you. Some people are going to hear this, and this may be it. This may be all they ever hear from you. If today, you know, was your last day, just anything you'd want to pass along that you've learned along the journey that strikes you as really germane, really important. Maybe you've already said it, or maybe there's another kernel or two out there, but anything else that you'd want listeners to maybe keep in mind or consider?
Yeah, I don't know why this one is now jumping at me. I kind of already mentioned Richard Rohr's comment or thing that he would say, that, you know, God loves us because he is good, not because we are good. But another one that was so influential to me, and this was said to be by my sponsor in the halfway house in Prescott, Arizona in 1988, when I went to his basement and we sat down there and we drank coffee and I smoked cigarettes, and he was about to take me through the work of Alcoholics Anonymous. But what he said is, he looked at me and he said, Charles, you've always been okay. Charles, the issue isn't whether you're okay. The issue is you don't know you're okay.
That had to be an aha moment for you.
It sure was. And it's in doing the work that I have found that out, that God doesn't make anything that isn't okay. Mm. So clearly the issue isn't whether I'm okay. The issue has always been that I didn't know I was okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And you had to do your work, and we have to do our work, and it, you know, it just takes us a long time to get there, you know. Just A-OK as we are, I think is the point.
Yep.
Is that correct? Yeah.
It's quite a trudge. It's quite a trudge. Trudging the road of happy destiny.
Yes, sir. Charles, you're a good man. Thank you so much for sharing this afternoon and visiting with us. And I'll see you in a week or two on our get-together with our Living School group, huh?
Mike, that's terrific. And folks, Mike is the reason that our circle group of nine so did so much together during our 2 years. He was really a glue that would go out of his way to help us. And then he did the same thing for us since we left to get us back on our Zoom meetings once a quarter. So, Mike, thank you for that. And I look forward to it also.
Well, thank you, and happy to do it. It's a pleasure. All right. Thank you.